Hey ho, Ramones fans, and welcome to the Pinhead Pod. I am your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining me for yet another episode. This show is available on all major podcast platforms and is also all over social media. It's pretty much on any platform. Just search for Pinhead Pod. On this episode, my guest is Tony Mann, longtime friend of the Ramones and designer for Joy Ramone. That interview is coming up in just a bit. First of all, our news for July. Rhino has released a limited box set titled 1-2-3-4, The Ramone Atmos Collection, featuring the band's first four albums, The Ramones, Leave Home, Rocket to Russia, and Road to Ruin. The albums feature Dolby Atmos mixes, and the set is limited to 2,000 copies. They're available at rhino.com. Now, some of her historical dates for July. July 5th, 1989, that was Dee Dee Ramone's last show with the band. The show was at One Stop Beyond in Santa Clara, California. Of course, he was replaced on bass in the band by Christopher Ward, who was rechristened CJ Ramone. Now, Dee Dee did appear at the Finals Ramone show at the Palace in LA on August 6, 1996, singing vocals on Love Kills. July 11, 2014, Tommy Ramone passed away. He passed away in his home at the age of 65 from bile duct cancer. He is buried at Mount Montefiore Cemetery in West Babylon, New York. July 15, 1952, Marky Ramone was born. Marky was born Mark Stephen Bell in New York, and Marky does have a twin brother named Fred who plays guitar in the band Teost. July 18, 1995, Adios Amigos was released. It is the final Ramones studio album. The album was recorded at Baby Monster Studios in New York, and it was released on Radioactive, produced by Daniel Ray. The album features two covers, six songs written by Dee Dee, two songs by Joey, two songs by CJ, who also sang some vocals on the album, and one by Marky. There is a hidden track on the album, a cover of the cartoon theme for Spider-Man. Now, we will discuss this album further on an upcoming bonus episode of the podcast. A little more information on that at the end of this episode. And July 20th, 1981, Pleasant Dreams was released. It is the sixth studio album from the band. The album was recorded in New York and England. It was released on Sire and produced by Graham Goldman. The album features seven songs written by Joey and five songs written by Dee Dee. All right, that takes care of all the dates and the history, the news, all that fun stuff. So it's time to move on to the interview. So let's take a break. When we come back, we'll have my guest, Tony Mann.
If you like horror movies, be sure to check out Dave Dynasty and Ike Isaacs on the Listen to Their Screams Horror Podcast. It is available on all podcast platforms and on social media at Listen to Screams. That is Listen, the number two, and Screams.
And welcome back to the Pinhead Pod. This time I'm being joined by longtime Ramones fan, Tony Mann. Tony, how are you?
Great, Dave. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, thanks for being on. And let's dive right into it, right? You grew up in New York, right?
Yeah, that's right.
When did you first encounter the guys in the Ramones?
In CBGBs. I didn't go to the first show or the first rehearsals or any of that stuff, but I did go to early shows at CBGBs. I was underage. I was already playing music. And my dad and my uncle, my family members would take me to shows and encourage my delinquency or whatever you want to call it. So, you know, if you walked around the East Village in those days, you'd run into some of the Ramones and get to be friends with them even. And it's like a whole different time than it is now.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain to people that aren't from here. Yeah. Kind of like by proximity, you had access to some people that got very famous at some point. I mean, at that point, they weren't, but it was an exciting time. And there were a lot of cool bands and a lot of things happening.
Yeah. So when you first saw them in those early shows there at CB's, what did you think of them?
That's really exciting. Gets your blood running, especially for a kid, you know. Some people used to think that they were a comedy show early on.
Yeah.
And not really get it, you know, but I got it. It was just like rock and roll, you know. Everybody wants to label stuff and pigeonhole things, but way back then on the radio, they would play Frank Sinatra and then Black Sabbath and then Jimi Hendrix. So it's only in, like, you know, years later when marketing and people started to pigeonhole things into different. Everyone wants to sound like they're an inventor.
Yeah.
Even, you know, okay, Ramones punk and everything, punk magazine and Ramones punk and whatever, but they weren't like all that hyping it up themselves. They were just playing music they liked, you know?
Yeah, and I don't, I mean, from what I've heard, I don't, they weren't really big fans of that punk label. From what I've heard, they just thought, you know, here they're just a rock and roll band, right? I mean, just
They're a rock and roll band, and you know, they wanted to play like music like Bay City Rollers and people like this, but you know, they couldn't even play it, so they just made their own music, which we all love to this day. So,
which is,
you
you know,
know,
that I mean, I guess at the core, that's punk though, right? I mean, if you can't play it,
yeah.
just do whatever you can. I mean, I guess that's
Well,
punk at its essence.
they are punk in attitude for
Sure,
sure. I mean,
absolutely. Yeah.
you know, they're all attitude, and a lot of New York rock is big on attitude and not virtuosity. You know, it's more like style
Yeah,
and
yeah.
just putting it out there, having the nerve to get out there and do your thing. You
Yeah,
know,
so
maybe sometimes before you even know what you're doing, you
that's
know.
right. Yeah. So you talked about, you know, some of the other, but what other bands were you seeing then in the scene that time? Tell us some of the other acts you were catching.
Oh my gosh, everybody who was playing at the time. I mean, I used to go even to the Fillmore East and see The Who and Humble Pie and all the great bands that were coming out that became super huge, you know, as well internationally. But it's funny because rock kind of went corporate at one point, you know, like when I was a kid, it wasn't. It was more like you love music and it was word of mouth. It wasn't, you know, there wasn't so much communication other than magazines. You know, we lived off of like Rock Scene magazine and Circus and Cream and, you know, Rolling Stone, not so much, but whatever. But, you know, some of these, especially Rock Scene, because it had a lot of New York goings on and you could figure out what was something cool to do and go to Max's and see bands there. You
Yeah.
know, I love New York Dolls, I love Dallas Cooper. You know, all kinds of T-Rex I loved as a kid
Yeah.
and would see all these bands live, you know. But we also had the bands coming out of CBGBs, and there was, you know, bands playing there before that, you know. And Hilly had a couple other spots too that my relatives knew him from a couple of his other spots, and he actually wanted to play like his shit kicker music, you know, like his
Yeah.
kind of like country hillbilly music,
That's
you
right.
know,
Yeah.
and these other people kind of forced their way into the scene and said, hey, we want to play here because it was a new place to play. There wasn't a lot of clubs there. You'd have to go see New York Dolls at like a broken down hotel or something, you know, or like Diplomat or Mercer Arts Center or something that wasn't even necessarily a proper venue, you know, because it wasn't the whole scene like it developed into. But like the Fillmore East and other bands, some of those bands got huge, and in fact that caused Bill Graham to shut down the Fillmore East because the bands got big and they'd come back and they'd want all kinds of money from Bill Graham to play, and he's like, I kind of helped make you famous, like, but you know, okay, he kind of shut the doors after a while. But I saw like even Voidoids were great. The Dolls, later the Heartbreakers were great, super great band. Dead Boys were super great live. You know, and those kind of bands. And Ramones were, you know, all these bands, it was a scene because of the locale, like in Blondie, of course. But before that was the Stilettos. They had Elda and Debbie was in the Stilettos with Tish and Snooki. But you know, there was a lot of local bands that were cool. Even Suicide was a super cool band that people still trying to figure it out now what it is, you know.
Well,
But there was a lot of exciting different bands. They were all different from each other. They all had their own sound, and they all had good songs, and they were fun to see live. And things would happen at their shows, like Dead Boys show, Steve Bader's would take out a bunch of insects at the show, or you know, blow his nose on baloney and throw it at you or something. I mean, there was always something that would happen at the show and people you would see at shows. And I was a kid, so I was just kind of being a little bit quiet in the background, taking it in, you know?
Well, and so
But
within that scene, right, you're talking about there's, I mean, a lot of diversity. A lot of different sounds, but it's, you know, everybody's just, it's just rocked everybody. Within that scene though, where did the Ramones, how were they viewed? Where did people see them and think, ooh, they've got a shot. They're one of the leaders here of this scene.
Well, I think that the thing about Ramones is that they stuck together. They were a band. They had songs. And if you got it, you got it. If you didn't get it, you didn't get it. Some people would look down on them and think, oh, they're not virtuosos, you know, think that they're, you know, oh, these guys aren't so bright or whatever. But you know what? It was a feeling at a Ramones show, a powerful feeling of momentum. Of those guys all hitting on the same thing. It's like a car when it hits on all the cylinders and it's just like taking off. It was a powerful feeling of air movement just pushing out from the stage. And they gave it all they had at those shows. They were like wrung out at the end of the shows, you know? And it was a powerful and you know, brief statements each song. So it didn't get boring. It was like, bam, next one, bam, next one. So it was kind of a new era because it was getting into bands that were kind of self-indulgent, that would go off on solos and sometimes lose the audience. You know, hey, I love all kinds of music. I like funk. I like all kinds of music. But the thing is, some of these bands, got to a point they were losing the audience, the connection with the audience. And I think that the one thing they had was a connection with the audience from the beginning.
It within, I mean, I guess when you're within a scene or within, you know, a town or whatever, and you have your local bands, I guess it would be hard to look at a band and think to yourself, oh, they're going to cross into just pop culture. Everybody's going to know that name. Everybody's going to know their logo. And they're going to do this for 20 something years. It's wild to, I mean, it's hard to think that, right? When you're seeing a band starting out.
Sure, because it took a while to develop a little bit. It shaped as it went on, and you know, yeah, the logo had something to do with it. Their unified look had something to do with it. They were like a gang, and living in New York at the time was like being in a gang because it wasn't all trendy and cool to live here. It was like, you know, sometimes like run for your life, you know. It wasn't all say like when CBGB's when I was a kid, that was a dangerous neighborhood. A cab, you couldn't get a cab to there or from there. You know, I would ride my bicycle sometimes. You know, I lived in Harlem and that was pretty far. And sometimes even Debbie Harry would give you a ride home in her car because she had a car. But the thing was, it was like being part of a gang to be in and from New York. And when bands would go play out of the city and say we're from New York, sometimes people would boo because it was, you know, after 9/11, people looked at New York in a different light, and you know, understandably. But back then, it was a bankrupt and dangerous city, and a lot of the downtown area was busted up, and it wasn't glamorous. It was just people trying to make their way. That's the only place stage they had to play. And Ramones would play at CBGB's and they'd go play in Canada and come back. And they wouldn't like really play in other parts of the country. And at one point, New York Dolls did that too. New York Dolls played in like every five boroughs for a tour one time. The tour was all five boroughs of New York. So later, David Bowie adopted that in one of his later tours. He did a Manhattan, New York tour of all the boroughs. So inspired by, you know, David Bowie was obviously inspired by all these bands, New York Dolls and Ramones and all this. And it kind of gave rock and roll a kick in the ass that it needed at the time. And I think people who had the opportunity to be here, the proximity to some of these people were like astounding. You would always run into Joey. He lived in the neighborhood, and at that point, Joey and Dee Dee lived with Arturo, like right near CBGB's, and we'd go up to Arturo's loft and hang out with them. And they pretty much wrote the first album in his apartment and made demos of it right there. And you know, you've seen some videos of them playing in front of that white sheet. Some of them were done in Arturo's. There's a couple of locations for that, but you know, they turned it into a TV studio to like film like a live footage of them that we see today. Back in the day, we didn't even see it. But like I said, we had magazines and the local scene, and these guys were local, and they would hang out and play pinball and eat in the place and whatever, and they were around. And they weren't like standoffish. You could talk to these guys. So I just tried to, be there and watch and learn what I could. And then get to play in CBGBs and later get to play with Dee Dee and be friends with, make clothes for Joey for many years and be friends with Tommy and pretty much all of them. I guess Johnny is the one I kind of knew the least, but I would speak to him about, science fiction or horror movies and baseball cards, because at one point I worked in a comic book store, and he knew, and he was all interested in that and baseball cards and baseball and things like that. But the other guys were always around, and Tommy's very friendly. DD could be very friendly, and I plan on his last album, so it's phenomenal for me as a kid growing up in that environment, and it's to eventually be friends with some of these guys and even perform and play with them was, or make clothes for them or whatnot, was really, really like not even a dream come true. I never even thought that would happen. It just happened,
Tell us that you, like you said, you wound up making clothes, well, particularly for Joey, right? A lot for Joey. How did
Yeah,
how'd that
I was
happen?
well, I became Joey's personal tailor basically for many years, because what happened is I would make clothes for myself, because what happened is I was in New Hampshire in high school, and that's a big culture shock from here. And I was making my own clothes, and I was just, bored of what was even the girls' clothes weren't even cool to wear at the time. Like some rock guys will wear like their girlfriend shirt or whatever it is. But even that stuff wasn't cool. So I was just trying to make my own rock clothes, even though there were some rock and roll stores like Manic Panic, which is always great, and Trash and Vaudeville and all these places, and Jumpin' Jack Flash and all those Granny Takes a Trips. But all that was like, too expensive and out of reach for a kid, and just I would instead just like get fabric and make stuff. And so I made stuff for myself, and then the next person I made stuff for was a guy by the name of G.G. Allin, who became an infamous punk rocker.
I'm
And
gonna talk
so
about
he
Gigi here
was
in a little
the,
bit.
yeah, so he was the first person I made clothes for besides myself. And then I played in his band for a while, and I recorded with him, and you can see me in a video, Live Fast, Die Fast, playing on top of a dumpster. And it's actually a long form video of us like acting some scenes and running around the city in New Hampshire. And it did get played on local video channels, and people thought it was MTV because they didn't know the difference at the time. And so anyway, I made stuff for Gigi, and then in New Hampshire I befriended a band. There was a band looking for a drummer called the Flying 69, and they at the time were almost the image of like Motorhead or bikerish, almost Ramones too, because they wore leather jackets. So that's cool. But basically we changed almost into a very theatrical band, like almost Alice Cooper and Kiss and those kind of bands. And I was making the costumes. So I made all kinds of, we worked on all kinds of complicated costumes and created these looks for ourselves, because you couldn't even buy it in the store. So anyway, we started playing down in this in Boston, and then we moved back down this area, and we were playing in the city, we were playing in clubs in Manhattan and all that. And people, my friends in the city, I was making clothes for a lot of different bands in the East Village at the time, because people would see our clothes and they would ask, hey, can you like fix my jacket or whatever? And I would say, I really don't know, but I make all these other things. And what I ended up making clothes for the band Degeneration. And at the time, Howie Pyro was a very good friend of mine, and Howie Pyro and Jesse Malin from Degeneration really championed me, and they gave me a lot of work at making repairing clothes for them. And then their clothes, like Howie ha was friends with Sid Vicious, and he would be wearing clothes that Sid Vicious gave him, and they'd be getting ripped. And then I finally just ended up making new clothes for him and making clothes for Jesse and these suits for Jesse. I was also at the time working with Jesse at Coney Island High. I was hanging up posters for Degeneration concerts and for Green Door parties, which were these dance parties they would have, and they would DJ. And it wasn't really live bands, it was just like a dance party. But Jesse would pay me, and the club would pay me to go around town because my band, Electric Monster at the time, the band that I joined in New Hampshire, I got them to move down closer to here. They would never really move into the city, but we had a house in Connecticut, and I would come down here and hang up giant 6-foot posters for my band. And then Jesse said, "Hey, would you hang up posters for the club and for Degeneration?" So I was hanging up everybody's posters in the city. I was making clothes for everybody. And then I would see Joey Ramone in the East Village a lot at Continental. He lived right off Third Ave. And he lived in a high rise. And anyway, everybody kind of knew where he lived. And I've met all those guys and known him for years, but I'd never really gone over to his apartments or anything. And Jesse told me, "Hey, Joey Ramone keeps asking me who makes my clothes." And I told him, "You, can I give him your number?" And I said, "Yeah, I mean, every day I see him and say, 'Hey, I'll like fix your clothes,' because I don't know how many people are aware of this, but Joey Ramone was over 6 feet tall. He was like 6'6". He was a really tall guy. And it wasn't easy for him to get clothes for himself either. So he was wearing whatever he could find, and it didn't always fit him great. And he'd be walking around the city, and I would say, "Hey, Joey, like, I will fix your clothes anytime." And he would never really call me. But once he got interested in Degeneration's clothes, he asked Jesse, and Jesse gave him my number. So I get this call from Joey Ramone one night, and he says, "This is Joey." And I mean, I already knew it was him by the sound of his voice right away. I said, "Joey Ramone, I know." And he said, "Hey, Jesse told me you make clothes, and the girl that makes my clothes, Susan, is leaving, and I need someone to work on my clothes." I said, "I'd be happy to." And he said, "Why don't you come over right now?" I said, "Great." And what happened was, I was on St. Mark's Place, a couple blocks away, and I actually dropped the phone and went over to work with Joey. And when I went home, the phone was still on the floor because I didn't even hang up the phone. I was so excited to go over there and work with him. So I went over and started working with Joey. And the girl who used to make Joey's stuff gave me some of his patterns and things. But Joey's weight fluctuated a lot. And he was drinking at certain times, his weight would go up, and he was sick for many years with lymphoma, and which he eventually passed from, which is really sad. And but the guy never complained about being sick. I would go see him in the hospital, and he wouldn't even complain. He wanted to play board games. But Joey, I went to his house. I got some patterns. I started making him some things to try on, and he could be a little bit awkward, to say the least, and nervous. And he tried on some things I made, and he basically destroyed them. And he was really upset and almost started crying. And I said, "Look, don't worry about it, man. We'll figure it out." And what I did was I put motorcycle zippers on the outside of his pants so he could, take them on and off easy and things like that. So I did stuff to make it easier for him to get dressed and undressed because he could be really nervous and awkward at times. And so the first time I went to his apartment, we're sitting there and we're both like staring across the room on the couch. And he said, "Are you nervous?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Why?" And I said, well, I mean, I've known you, but we're just sitting here and now we're going to work together. I don't really know what to say. And I said, I'm kind of nervous because you're actually like a big star. And he said, oh, you know, come on. And I'm just like, whatever, don't say that. And he did. He was a very humble guy and sweet guy. And I said, well, did you ever look up to anyone and you were nervous around them? And he told me this great story. He went to go up to Manny's, which was a music store on 48th Street in Manhattan. And there was a couple streets of just music stores up there in Times Square at the time. They're all gone now. And Manny's was a really famous store. The Beatles shopped there. Everybody shopped there. So Joey went there when he was a kid. And he saw Jimi Hendrix in the store, but the store was locked up because Jimi Hendrix was in there shopping. They kicked everybody out. So Hendrix himself saw Joey at the door and came up to the door and said, hey, kid, do you want to come in and hang out? And he like welcomed him in. So he said that inspired kind of his whole career. He said that Joey thought I was cool enough to come in and hang out. It like changed my life. And you know, he would go to like Murray the K shows with Dad Hendrix and the Who and all those people. They were his ultimate idols. I remember him when they did the Acid Eaters and Pete Townshend playing on Substitute. He was so excited because, and I say, hey, I love the Who too. I saw when they played Tommy at the Fillmore East. So it was a super important band for so many people, you know. It was an exciting band. So they, you know, and a lot of honestly, a lot of bands from New York all, you know, love the British bands, you know, the Beatles and Dave Clark Five and the Who and T-Rex and Slade and all that. And one time Joey said, also, I saw some Slade record on his shelf, and I said, oh, I love Slade. So we're listening to Slade, and he got some videos, and we're watching Slade, and he got on the phone and he called Noddy Holder of Slade in England. And he said, I'm here with a friend. He's making my clothes, and we love Slade, and we wish you would come back together, come back with the band and play. And he puts me on the phone with Noddy Holder. I said, hey, man, I'm here making clothes with Joey. I love Slade. You're fantastic. I've seen Slade a bunch of times. Amazing band. I know you're not going to come back, but it's sweet. Joey called you up to say hello because we got all excited talking about you. But he said, tell Joey thanks. But I'm kind of not doing music at the time. But Joey was a fan, you know, and I think all the Ramones guys were fans of different bands. And like I said, I saw the Voidoids with when Mark was in it. And I thought he played great in the Voidoids. That was a super cool band too. Influenced the Sex Pistols and other bands later. And a lot of early bands here were had something to do with Warhol. You know, Warhol obviously behind the Velvet Underground. He made a Blank Generation film that had a lot of these bands like Voidoids and you know, they're just kind of like a patron of the arts, you know. So like I said, the place was all ramshackle and busted, and you're trying to go see some band at some like burnt out old hotel or whatever the case may be. But CBGB's was like a almost like a clubhouse to people that were from here. And you know, I had a good friend, I have a good friend, Jamie Gorman, who did sound at CBGB's for many years. And he would and at the at, towards the end of CBGB's, it wasn't that popular. It was empty a lot and nobody was kind of doing anything there in a way. A local band. It was always a place for local bands. You know, some bands got famous or whatnot, but it wasn't a place for like big stars. It was like a local place, honestly, almost the whole time through. And so towards the end, our band, when I was in She Wolves, we played a show with Sylvain from New York Dolls and Jane County in our band
Oh,
there, you
cool.
know, and it wasn't even advertised as that. We just played. So, you know what I mean? It was like a place where you were there and you saw it or you missed it. That's it. That's kind of what it was like then. You didn't, there wasn't almost no heads up. You might know there was a show, but other things can happen. And oh, Keith Richards showed up or whatever the heck happened. You know, anyone could show up because you're in New York. Everybody was coming through here.
Now, when I talked to Rick Johnson, he was a
Rick said he was close to Joey, right? Got close to Joey, and then had trouble
Absolutely.
because of that. He thinks he had trouble kind of getting to know Johnny at all because
Of course,
Johnny
yeah.
viewed as, you're a
Well,
Joey guy. Do you think?
look, if you were in a vehicle with Ramones going somewhere,
Yeah.
they were all not talking to each other.
Yeah.
And then if you talk to one of them, they're like, "Why are you talking to him?" I'm like, "He's my friend. You're here with me." Like, it was very, very territorial and possessive and funny, and that's the way it was.
Yeah, well, you said
And
earlier that
but
Johnny's the one maybe that you didn't know quite as well. Do you think Johnny viewed you as a Joey guy because you made his clothes and stuff, and maybe that's why?
well, this is much later on when I was doing that.
Oh,
But I was there just like as a fan sometimes. And yeah, if you were there with someone, the other person might not be as friendly to you. That's true. But I'd say overall, Tommy was really the sweetest guy. And he got out
Yeah.
of the band as soon as he could. He
Sure,
didn't
yeah.
even want to be in the band. It wasn't his
Yep.
idea.
Right,
He just
yeah.
couldn't get a drummer, so he just ended up doing it.
Yep, right.
And he was a wonderful guy. And, towards the end of his life, and he had that great band with his wife, Claudia, Uncle Monk, that was a duo. And at the time, I was working on Mark Costabile's TV show. This all happened because of Dee Dee, really. And Tommy came and played with Uncle Monk. And then, we saw how great he was and masterful on, acoustic instruments. Like him and Claudia were singing and playing around one mic, and he would turn around when it was the lead and hold the guitar up to the mic. He thought like an engineer, and
Yeah.
he actually played some guitar on Ramones records, and he, was an engineer and really critical of sound and really thought about songs and sound, and he was a really sweet guy. But then I helped him, Uncle Monk, get some other gigs. And they were like, gaining in popularity. They were really cool. It was a cool,
Yeah.
cool duo. I'm glad we got to see them. But I went to LA to visit some friends once. And Dee Dee, right before Dee Dee moved to LA, he played in a local bar called Lakeside near Tompkins Square Park. And my friend, Paul Kostabi, the artist, he made White Zombie and Psychotica and a lot of other bands. He produced Dee Dee's last album, Youth Gone Mad, featuring Dee Dee Ramone. And I end up playing on it. But what happened is I went to LA to visit some friends. Again, Howie Pyro, who was in Degeneration. And Howie told me, look, you don't have to leave. But at the time, he was playing in Danzig. He was living with Glenn Danzig in his guest house in Los Angeles. And so anyway, he said, you don't have to leave, but I'm gonna tell Glenn that the band is quitting and we're making another band. And so I said, well, I'm not sticking around for that. Good luck with that. I mean, I think you should stay in Glenn's band and do your thing on the side. But anyway, I felt like, why did I even come to LA? But Dee Dee, I had seen Dee Dee at Lakeside, and he told me, I'm moving to LA. Here's my number. Call me when you get there. And I said, I don't really go to LA that often. But all of a sudden, I found myself in LA. I called Dee Dee, and his phone number was already no good anymore. So it was kind of like, oh, well, I felt kind of like just coming home. Like, why did I come here? Like, a lot of people had gone to Coachella. My other friends were kind of almost, leaving Danzig, so that wasn't going to be too comfortable. And so anyway, I'm looking for something to do, and I saw in the LA Weekly, Dee Dee was doing a book signing at Borders Books in Santa Monica. So I went to that. And at the end, Dee Dee came up to me and he said, oh, I'm so happy you're here. I said, your phone number is already no good. I tried to call you. Said, I'm here for a little while, but I don't know, not much to do. He said, oh, I'm doing a show at Knitting Factory. And I'm also going to be showing my art with Paul Kostabi and reading. Why don't you come to that? Come to the sound check tomorrow. So I went. He had already fired the band. He had a fight with the band and he threw all the gear in the street and broke it. So he told me, like, I'm not going to play. These people are horrible. I'm going home. And I said, this show is for you. You can't just go home. I'm like, what about people who are coming to see you? And he said, you're right. I've known you for a long time. Why don't we just play the two of us? Like, just like that. And I said, okay, sure. And it was going to be like right then. There was no rehearsal and nothing. And I said, well, what are you going to do? You just broke all your gear. And there were some guys eating dinner. And there was some gear on stage. And I said, whose gear is this right here? And Dee Dee said, those guys sitting right there eating. So I said, hey guys, can we use your gear to play? And they said, sure. And so I said, I don't even have drumsticks. I didn't come here to play. I just came to see Dee Dee. The guy said, use everything. So I played drums and Dee Dee played guitar. And Mary Lambert, who made Pet Sematary, the movie, the director of Pet Sematary, she was there and she was filming Dee Dee. And she also made Pet Sematary, the video, too, for the song. And she's there filming. And Dee Dee said to me, can you tell her to like leave? Because we have to talk like under the, our dressing room was like under the stairwell. It wasn't even like a real kind of dressing room. And I don't know where his assistant was, but just me and him were there. So I said, I'm sorry, but could you go? Like, we need to talk. Like, we're gonna play now and we haven't even rehearsed. So he gives me a set list of like 30 songs, which we played all of them. I still have the set list. And no rehearsal, you know? We just got up there and played. And she filmed it. And there is some footage on YouTube, but she filmed him. She said, Dee Dee said he was being filmed for her like all week. And I don't know where all the rest of the footage is, but there was a lot of people there, like Anthony Kiedis from Chili Peppers and Bauhaus and Iggy and all kind of people. And Arthur Lee of Love just got out of jail. And he, all these people were there, right? But nobody I knew, like all my friends were at Coachella or, you know, Fighting with Danzig, whatever the time. So anyway, so all my friends didn't even get to see me play with Dee Dee. It was really weird. So we played, and then he read this book about Joey, who had already died, and that Joey's a beautiful dragon and all this stuff. And he was, everybody in the whole place is crying, you know. And we played like almost 30 songs, and then he had his art show, and it was wonderful. And the next day that Arthur Lee got out of jail and played there, and we got to go to that show and meet Arthur Lee and talk to him. And then I rehearsed with Dee Dee and Barbara and his wife Barbara Stampini, and because she didn't play with us at the show, just me and Dee Dee played as a duo, which I think is really rare. And it was great. And he said, oh, I like you play like Jerry Nolan of the Dolls. He's my favorite, so that's great. And so Dee Dee said, Paul Kostabi is doing my album in New York. I want you to play drums on it. And I said, great. So I did play with Dee Dee. I played with him in LA. And then he had the art show. And I wanted to buy one of his paintings, but they were out of my price range. He had done all these paintings with Paul Kostabi. And he said, don't worry, just come by my apartment and I'll give you one. So I went by his apartment and he gave me a painting of him and it says, I'm against it. It's like a cartoon of him, really funny. And so he gave me that. I still have it. It's wonderful. And when we were going to go see Arthur Lee, we went to Jet Rag, which is a vintage clothing store out there. And he bought me some clothes to wear to the show, like this psychedelic shirt and like a black suede hat with a spider on it. And it's like, this is like psychedelic, we should dress up. So people probably didn't even know he was Dee Dee at the show. He was dressed like psychedelic. And we didn't even have tickets. We went to the door and he said, hey, we played here last night. Can we come in? And they said, sure. Didn't even know he was Dee Dee.
Well,
And
tell me. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
so anyway, he used to have a big dog called Banfield, and he lived in like an apartment with Barbara, who was he had met in South America, and he taught her to play bass. And then we went and rehearsed with Barbara at Swing House Studios, and all these people were there. Chili Peppers were there, Bauhaus was there. Actually, Danny Sage from Degeneration was there. I saw Clem Burke in the hallway, and I saw DJ from X. And I went, "Why are you guys here?" And they said, "We're playing on Danny Stage from Degeneration's album." And I said, "Hey, well, I played on those demos, so we went over to the studio and saw him, and they were playing on his album. We had a jam with the Chili Peppers, me and Dee Dee. His Flea came knocking on the door, and we ended up hanging out with Flea a little bit. He loved Dee Dee. And so Dee Dee and me and Barbara were gonna go play in Japan. And we were also gonna play some warm-up shows in like Oregon, just to warm up, to play as a three-piece, and then we're gonna play in Japan. And he bought some land with Paul Kostabi, and they had been painting together, and they would just, I think he was gonna stop, kind of phase out playing music and just get into his art and other things. And he came and stayed with us a couple times in New York, but and he played a big event at Roseland with Paul Kostabi and Arturo Vega and some other people, and Daniel Ray and Marky. And but I didn't even want to go to that because I didn't want to be in the middle of it all, you know. It's like, and he also invited me, so he told me he was going to go to Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I said, "You got to go and make a speech because no one's really going to talk about your songwriting unless you do."
Yeah.
So I'm glad we encouraged that.
One of
So the girl that was his
one of the best acceptance speeches ever.
incredible, but he really, like, you know, his publicist lived on my block, Alicia,
Yeah.
and she was the publicist for his books, and like I mentioned in one of his books. And so Dee Dee wanted me to go to Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I said, "I'm definitely not going to that. I mean, go with the band. I'm not part of your of Ramones. Come, I have respect for the pecking order of what it is, you know what I mean? I respect everyone who's been in the Ramones, and they earned it, you know." And so I'm not, I wasn't in the Ramones. I did play with Dee Dee, luckily, and made clothes for Joey. But anyway, so he invited me to go to Rock Hall of Fame. He was gonna buy me a ticket. I said, "It's thousands of dollars. I'm not going to that." But he went with some other friends, and the publicist Alicia went, and he went, and CJ, and she kind of like had a crush, and she fell for CJ, and she started like going out with CJ. So that was like a whole thing. But Dee Dee, I feel, really was trying to like reinvent himself again at the end. He actually did a blues album that never even came out with Paul, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm glad I get to play with him and record with him. It's like, it's an honor. It's amazing. I talked to Marky about it because I've also played with Jane County, and so did he. And I don't know, people I look up to as a kid, they inspired me. Guys like him and Clem Burke and Jerry Nolan and all these guys as a kid, seeing those guys play, that's how I learned to play, you
Yeah.
know. And they were nice enough to talk to me and, you know, tell me whatever tips and whatever, you know. So it luckily we had the proximity to be around these people. And they were almost always, you know, super nice and accommodating to me and generous with their time. So I felt lucky to know them. And Joey was a really sweet guy. Like I said, he never really was sick for so long, but it was only like one time he really complained about being sick. I had gone to see him up at like Sloan Kettering. He was getting some treatments, and he wanted to play board games when we were there, and I just said, "Let's just sit here and be quiet and talk." Like, you know, it's like too much excitement. You're getting like blood taken out and clean. You know, it's very serious medical things going on, and he's just bored, so he wants to do something fun, but it's just not a fun time, you know.
Yeah.
And but anyway, I was happy to visit him in the hospital a couple times, and then I went to see him at his apartment, and he wanted to go bowling one day. So there was a bowling alley nearby that he, you know, used to bowl at sometimes. And that was a whole other event to see Joey bowling. Anyway, so I went to go by his place, and his face was like all black and blue. He didn't look right at all. So I said, "Are you okay?" And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "Did you look in the mirror today?" And he said, "No." I said, "Well, maybe go look in the mirror." And you know, I guess he had had an allergic reaction to something they put in his blood. So Kind of, if I hadn't gone by there right then, who knows what might have happened right then, you know? He had to like do a lot right then. He had to go back to the hospital. So, but he only one time I ever went over when he said, like, I don't feel good. I can't go out. But usually, you know, he was pretty hearty guy. And, you know, it was amazing to see him even tour, you know, and everything during all this stuff. Like, that's a serious, a serious illness to have, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, you
Yeah,
know.
it is. Yeah. And I know this is kind of a side note, but I cannot bring back up. You talked about that you also made clothes for Gigi Allen. And
Yeah,
I got to hear a little about Gigi Allen just because he's this
all right,
larger
so
than life personality, right? That so much is said
yeah, of
about him and
course.
that he played up. But what?
Well, I actually know him as Kevin, okay,
Sure,
because
right.
he was a baptized Jesus Christ Allen, but you know, going to school in New Hampshire, it caused quite a stir. New Hampshire and Vermont, where those guys grew up, it was pretty controversial to be saying you're Jesus Christ, you know. And so they grew up in a log cabin. His father was pretty intense, and his the mother caught the father digging a grave in the basement one night. So she took the kids away. Basically, he said he was going to bury the whole family in a grave under the house. So anyway, Gigi was actually a drummer, right? And he was in a couple bands as a drummer, and him and Merle had a couple different bands they were in. And what happened was Gigi was living in Manchester, New Hampshire. Right, which is a big city. It's not the capital, but it's a big city in Manchester, in New Hampshire rather. And I was living there with the band I joined too, and I was a cab driver, and I would pick him up and drive him to like cash a check he would get, and he didn't really have a bank account, so I would help him cash his checks, and I got friendly with him. And anyway, I had like known about him before because David Peel from Lower East Side, who a guy, a hippie guy who wrote about marijuana, John Lennon joined his band, and then he discovered Gigi and signed him to his label, which was called Orange. You know, the Beatles had Apple Records. Well, David Peel had Orange, and so David Peel discovered Gigi and put out some of his early recordings. Then he even had like guys from MC5 come and record with Gigi and everything, you know. Because he knew so many people from Elektra Records, he was connected. So Gigi was, even though he was living in New Hampshire, he had record deals in France on New Rose Records. But like I said, he didn't even sometimes have a bank account or way to cash his check. I would take him to his like post office box and get to be friends. We had that he wanted our band, who are like these biker psychedelic rock freaks, to be his side band, you know. And I end up playing on some stuff and in some videos with him, and I got along with him great. He was really funny. He had a real sadistic sense of humor. There was always girls around, and we had fun times. We had fun shows. And but the only thing about when he would play a show, he would often end up in the hospital or get arrested or in a fight or something. It was always some super high drama. But as a one-on-one friend, he was a very good friend. And I liked him. I thought it was really funny. I had good times hanging out with him. But you know, I know him from a different era than most people. This is a long time ago in the 80s, you know, way before he was doing, you know, the crap and all that stuff. He was at the time, he would mostly like almost be like Iggy or cut himself or knock people's drinks over. He got more and more extreme as he went to jail and learned about like the serial killer culture and have like John Wayne Gacy and people like this in his life, you know. So it got to be very extreme, and he was very serious about music, but at some point, like people when his music wasn't getting to the top of the charts or whatever, he just went the other way just to make a name for himself, and he became notorious. And it got more and more extreme. And I even saw him the last day he was last couple of days he was alive here in New York. I hadn't seen him for years, and because like I said, we played with him way back. I was not in the Jabbers, but I was in like the Scumfucks, Cedar Street Sluts, and those era bands. And I did play with Alan Chapel, who was in the Jabbers, but I didn't even see Gigi for quite a long time. And one time I was putting up posters in East Village, and I heard him call my name, and there he was. And he was wearing a hood, and he had, busted out all his teeth, and he's wearing cowboy boots and shorts and all this. And he said, "Hey, I'm playing a show." He said, "Are you guys still playing?" I said, "Yeah, here's a poster right here. We were going to play the next week." But he was playing like in a couple days at the garage in my over here in the Lower East Side, my neighborhood. And so I went by the show, but this, and he gave me a flyer, which I still have. And the flyer I have is in the book called St. Mark's is Dead, that flyer that he gave me for his last show. I went by the last show, and it just ended because he got in a big fight with everybody in there and just ran out of there. And you can watch the video of what happened, but I showed up at the very end, and then you see him running down the street, and then that was. He OD'd with some people, in the neighborhood there, which is really sad. But personally, I love Kevin. I thought he was a fun friend to have. He really, we loved a lot of the same music. Like we, would go see all the same rock bands. And I remember hanging out with him and we would see Joe Perry or people like that. We would see Aerosmith or Alice Cooper or whatever bands he liked, all kinds of rock. Like I said, our band at the time looked almost like Alice Cooper or Kiss, and he wanted us to be his band. We're called the Flying 69. So on that Live Fast Die Fast EP, it says special thanks to the Flying 69 right on the label. Like, where else do you see that on one of his records? Because he wanted us to be his band. So a lot of people would get confused about our band and him because he mentioned us and everything. So, but I'm proud to have known him, and like I said, he's the first person I made clothes for, and I still have some things I made for him, and you can see me in the Live Fast Die Fast video. And there was a time when we were really close, hanging out a lot, because there was nothing to do in Manchester, New Hampshire, except what you would do in Manchester, New Hampshire is go to Elm Street and hitchhike up and down the street and get in different people's cars and party with strangers. That's what you did for fun there. And it was like a different time. And oh, there's a funny thing because, like I said, we made that video for Live Fast, Die Fast. And at the time they were playing Headbangers Ball, right? But they would have a local segment, but they played that video during Headbangers Ball. So everybody who was watching that in the whole basically New England area would see us like we're on MTV. So he got kind of famous from that, so everybody knew us from the video. It was kind of weird. It was like we didn't have any money, but you kind of didn't need any money because everybody would give you free food at the restaurant. You go in a record store and they give you the records, or it was like being a rock star even in this little community is how I can put it. And he And in this little record store called Inner Light Records, say if whatever big rock band put out their album, Gigi's latest record was selling more than them in that record store because locally he was so popular and notorious, people would get it just to check it out because they heard about it. It got like famous even when he was still alive. But then he went and traveled and he had many other bands. And when I was in the band, Merle was not around. That's when Merle, if you watch that All in the Family movie, it talks about that you can see me in there playing on top of the dumpster or whatever. But that's in the part when Merle says, "I don't know why, but I, quit music and I had a family and I don't know what happened." That was the time when Merle quit rock. So that's when I was around the band. And then when I moved back to New York, Merle was my neighbor, lived one block away at one point, which was really funny because I got to know him more later because he was a guy who sold live recordings in the East Village and stuff like that. He was a guy who was around. He was a vendor, like in the street selling live concerts of whatever bands. So
Yeah.
people in the East Village used to know Merle. He'd be like in front of Kim's Video selling, Mott the Hoople live or whoever,
Yeah.
right? Or Gigi's stuff. But Gigi got more and more famous, and it keeps getting more famous even as time goes by. And honestly, more people ask me about Gigi than anything in a way, but and hey, I'm proud to have known him, but it's so funny to have been in this community and then that's who, I befriended, you know what I mean? So okay, so we found something fun to do even there, because there wasn't much fun right there at that place, I can tell you. It was a lot of trouble and not much to do. If you had long hair, nobody would hire you. Luckily I was a cab driver, but I was kind of like an outlaw really. And we were all kind of like, I guess, subversive underground people. We weren't even in society, I guess you'd say, So
Yeah.
we could see that, and that's why we got along. And I always got along with Kevin, Gigi. I'm glad I saw him right before he died, and I wish he was still around. But in some ways, he's not missing much.
Yeah, it's
It's
true.
like it's like Joey died before, 9/11 and things like this. He didn't even get he wasn't even alive when they got inducted into Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yep.
So things have changed in the last couple decades, and for a while everything was the same. It didn't change. And then a lot of changes happened. And
Yeah.
in those days we just had to make our own fun. And that's why I made my own clothes. And then it led to other stuff. I didn't have some big goal of being a designer. Just people asked me because I made clothes that looked weird. Hey, can you fix my jacket? I don't know. And then luckily I friends of Howie and these and Jesse Malin, and they really encouraged it and pushed me on other people. And then Joey even managed a couple people. Joey managed a band called the Independents, and I was making clothes
Yeah.
for them too.
Yeah,
And
yeah. That's a good bit.
that'd be a good person for you to interview. Evil Presley, Chris, he
Yeah.
lived in Joey's building when Joey died, and in fact he could have stayed living there, but he just felt like he should leave.
Yeah.
And Joey had his first apartment was on the corner of the building, and all his apartments were on the same floor, but they weren't connected, so it was really fun. That's like him, because he had like really OCD and ADD and all kinds of cognitive problems that he had to get deal with to get through the day. Joey,
Yeah.
he wasn't. He had a lot of mental and physical issues. And for him to be on stage, standing up at the mic, like the Statue of Liberty, it was like amazing. If you knew the guy as a person, that he could do that is astounding. And it's only because of the power of music that he could do that and get past his, whatever you call it, shortcomings, disabilities, whatnot.
Yeah.
But he was a wonderful guy. And he was very generous, and he used to let me stay in his apartment. And I know Chris stayed there for some time, Evil Presley from Independence. And they were a band that were also like horror kind of metal ska
Yeah.
sounding band from the South. And they were really nice guys, and Joey loved them. And Joey loved Degeneration. And he if he loved people, he'd wear their shirts. He would talk about them on the radio. Go on Howard Stern, talk about him, promote shows, whatever. And so he loved Degeneration. He loved Independence. So I think that'd be a good person for you to talk to, because he'd have great stories about Joey. One time I was in an elevator with Joey, Chris from Independence, and me. And they're both really big guys. And the elevator fell, and they fell on top of me. And I felt like a giraffe fell on top of me. Okay. Just felt crazy. These guys were like giants, especially Joey was 6'6", man. He was a big dude.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll take, one of his patterns from his pants and show people, like, look, his waist came up to like my chest, you know, like he was a really tall guy. And he was a unique guy. And all the guys in Ramones were, they had a lot of character, you know, they really had a lot of personality, and it came out in their music and came out in that when you spoke to them. And each guy had their own unique personality. And I liked everybody that was in the band, you know, I like the original lineup, amazing. And Marky came in, and you know, I know Jane County told me that she's one of the people that told them they should get Marky when they were looking for a drummer later on. And you know, Richie, we had CJ, and all those guys played a part in it. And I like all the records, and so many great songs, and so many great memories of exciting, super exciting shows till the end. I never saw a boring Ramon show, you know. I just thought, and I think the last New York show was Coney Island High. That was a big one anyway, because I worked in the club a lot, you know, doing whatever with the posters and making clothes for the bands. So I was around Coney Island High a lot. I played there sometimes, and Ramones played there one of the last shows, and they warmed up backstage and everything. We watched them rehearse backstage before they went on, and it was just it. I wish the last show would have been in New York, but it was in LA because Johnny had moved there, so it was a little weird to me, but whatever. And yeah, I love Ramones, and it was great to get to know all those guys. Did you you're in the Midwest, right?
Well, I'm
Where are you?
originally I'm well, I'm in North Carolina. I'm originally from the Midwest. I'm originally from Indiana.
Oh, okay.
Lived most of my life in Indiana, but I'm now in North Carolina.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm going to North Carolina tomorrow, actually.
Ah, there you go.
Going to Charlotte, and yeah, I'm going to Charlotte tomorrow. So,
It's about 3 hours from me.
yeah, so amazing. But did you see Ramones play where? Did you see the Ramones with which lineups?
The later year in Indianapolis, the later years,
Okay,
like when they were
great.
doing, yeah, when they were doing, especially like when they did the Lollapalooza and stuff like that, they
Right,
would,
right.
and they came through Indianapolis. It would have been more
Right.
the CJ years and stuff.
That's great though. And he get really revived it. It got to be something else, which
That's
was great.
right.
It kept the band going. And Dee Dee was still writing songs then and everything anyway. So it really had kept the spirit going. And Lollapalooza, I remember, because later I played with Psychotica. Like I said, Paul Kostabi made Psychotica. He's the one who produced Dee Dee's album. And they played on Lollapalooza in '96. Psychotica played, so you probably saw them. You saw Lollapalooza. So that's Paul Kostabi, Ine, who made White Zombie. He was the original guitar player in White Zombie, and he helped create the band. He made Youth Gone Mad, and he made Psychotica, and they toured with on that Lollapalooza with Metallica and Ramones and all those other bands. So that was an exciting time for me to go to those shows. So yeah, pretty cool. And then you know, and so we have some mutual friends, and I heard the shows, you know, Monty told me about your show. Monty's a great guy.
He is.
You know, it's you know what I really miss is that, like I said, we used to hang out at Arturo Vega's loft right near CBGB. So whenever there'd be an event, we would go to Arturo's loft and hang out with the guys in the band or whoever was there. And then even up to the time when like Joey Street signed Dedication, I had a couple pieces up on the wall as a tribute to Joey. And we went over to Arturo's after that with Tommy and everybody. And you know, so that was like another extension of CBGB's almost, you know? And so it, like I'm saying, like I'm lucky to have the proximity of all these things, and I guess just the nerve to go up to anyone and talk to anybody, because I don't care. I'll go say hello and meet people. And but luckily, from what I did, people asked to work with me and things, which were great. And you know, because what happened is I was making clothes, but I was still learning all along. And when Joey was asking for me to make his clothes, you know, I really was still in a learning phase, but I wasn't going to say no to Joey. You're going to say no, I'm not going to work with you. No, I was thrilled, but I just kept learning. And then I ended up working with this guy, Miguel Cruz, who had worked with a real fashion designer, Charles James, who was really knew his stuff. He's like one of the most acclaimed couturier, which is a custom clothes designer. So I learned from some really good people later, but I still kind of had training wheels on when I was making stuff for Joey. And I know that Mickey, his brother, inherited some of those clothes and would see some of them, and all these people. It's funny because I didn't get rich or famous making clothes for Joey or a lot of other people, but everybody at the time knew I was doing it. I wasn't advertising. Joey was really shy and I didn't ever want to make him nervous. So I would never even take a picture with him. In fact, I didn't have any pictures of me and Joey, I don't think, until well after he passed away. One time, Beth Levinsky Magnum, she's married to Jeff Magnum of the Dead Boys, right? She posted a picture of me and Joey on a roof talking. The roof of Coney Island High, because there was a Memorial Day cookout, and we all helped Joey get up this crazy ladder to the roof, and it was and down, and it was, believe me, it took like an army of people to get him up there and down. He was nervous, and but there's a picture of me talking on the roof at a Memorial Day cookout, and that years after he passed, honestly, I got that picture, and it's pretty amazing that that showed up, but you never know what's going to turn up on the internet. It could be some video out there too, or film
That's
that
right.
might show up. I keep looking. At least I knew the video of Gigi existed, and there's footage with me and Dee Dee a little bit playing. But she took a lot more, Mary Lambert. Maybe if you talk to her, you find out where the rest of all the. She called me looking for footage one time. I said I was the guy playing. I didn't film anything, and so anyway. Yeah, so I'm glad to have that picture. But like I said, he was nervous. I didn't want to make him any more nervous. He was my friend. I wasn't trying to impress people that he was my friend. He really was my friend. And it was really heartbreaking when he passed. And there'd been a time where I hadn't made anything for him because he'd been so sick. But not long before he died, he called me and said, "Hey, I lost some more weight. I want you to come make some stuff for me." But then other people told me, yeah, it's probably not going to happen, but he's reaching out to you. So, I wasn't there when he passed or anything like that, but I was devastated when Joey died. I was like crying for 2 weeks, and everybody was in New York. And in fact, I had an offer to perform with Cheap Trick because there was these parties for Joey. Like Joey would have a birthday party, but they still had it even though he passed away, and it was now moved to a bigger venue, and Cheap Trick and Blondie and all these people going to play because Joey died. And Bunny Carlos, the drummer Cheap Trick, had told me that there was, he had some back problems and they were going to play. Could I play? And I said, I can't even function. I said, Cheap Trick's one of my favorite bands, but I can't. I'm not even going to go to that event. And I didn't go to Joey's funeral. And I only visited his grave recently, kind of by accident, because I was at a record store in New Jersey and they had some Ramones stuff on the wall. And my friend said, "Oh, Tony here used to make clothes for Joey, and oh, he's buried right down the street." So I couldn't not go, so we went and saw his grave. And his grave is, over the hill in New Jersey. And I always wondered why he was buried in New Jersey. It's because there was like a family plot. There's other family members nearby. And there's a view of the city of Manhattan from his grave, and people left all these tributes there, which is nice. So I'm glad I saw it. But at the time when he died, I just couldn't even function. I mean, it was like a really important person in my life. Not that it wasn't to the people who went, obviously, but I just, everybody reacts differently to those kind of things. I just think so. What happened is Charlie Drayton, who was married to Chrissy Amphlett of Divinyls, he ended up playing with Cheap Trick at that event. But I didn't even go. I couldn't even go.
Yeah.
And Dee Dee passed away. Dee Dee had like burned a lot of bridges with some people, and there wasn't like a there was a huge shrine in front of CBGB's when Joey died. For a long time, they had to put up like a police barricade and everything, because so many people left flowers or whatever. And when Dee Dee died, it was like me and CJ and Paul Kostabi and Daniel Ray and a few people put up a few things, but it was like Dee Dee had a lot of weird times here as, a drug addict and things like that, and a lot of people were freaked out by him sometimes. But I have to say, the last times I saw Dee Dee, he was really sweet to me, and it was great to be around him, and it was great to play with him, and we and play on his album, and I'm glad I did and got to know him even more. And I remember when Degeneration was first ever going on a tour, and they were in the bus on like St. Mark's Place or something, getting ready to leave New York, and Dee Dee just happened to walk by, and he came on the bus and said, and he said, "We're going on tour," and Dee Dee said, "Oh no!" So he was like worried for them, He had seen the good side and the awful sides of the music industry, and
Yeah.
he had a he you know he's an underrated songwriter, honestly. So I'm
Yep.
glad
Yep.
we got him to go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing and do that, and I'm glad we get to record with him and get to know him more. And it's really sad to hear that he died, because I wish he was still around. All these guys.
Yeah.
Tommy was such a lovely, sweet guy. In
Yeah.
fact, we played at the Jeff's, before Ramones, Monty was a bass player, right, in a couple different bands.
Yeah.
And Monty was in a couple different, he was in a label band that had records out, and he also had a band with Jeff Salen and Tommy, they had a band called Butch, right? Well, and Harry Verdurci, who was the drummer of the Sick Fox, was on drums in Butch, and Butch was almost like Slade type of band,
Yeah, wasn't money in that band?
Monty was in it, yeah. But
Yeah,
what
yeah.
happened is, I was in She Wolves, a lot of times people would join our band, and we'd be playing for them now. Like, we're playing for Sylvain, and then we're playing for Jane County, and you're not really going to say no. These people are amazing, and you learn from them.
Yeah.
But sometimes it would like we'd be doing our album, and then, oh, Sylvain's in our band, kind of drop everything, and that's what we're doing now. But anyway, Jeff Salen for some time was coming to She Wolf shows and play with us, and he kind of wanted to be in She Wolves. He was in Tough Darts and some other bands. He played in Sparks, played on Sparks album, The Big Beat, which to me is like amazing,
Yeah.
and like a local hero. He's a great guitar player. Anyway, so when he died, She Wolves, we played at the memorial, and Monty was there and Tommy, and then when Sylvain needed to do a recording for a South American Ramones tribute album, Todos Somos Ramones, I don't know if you
Yeah.
know that one.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
So the first song on that is She Wolves with Sylvain playing Sheena's a Punk Rocker. So Ed Stasium worked on that, and Tommy worked on that. So, I've got to know these guys in different aspects, you know what I mean? Like different
Yeah.
times we cross paths, and honor to me, because it's like I said, who we've learned from, who we looked up to. To me, they were as big as the Beatles, to me,
Yeah, right.
because they're the guys that we get to know and get to talk to in real life. And even though I've met all kinds of famous people, it's still from New York, these guys are here. And you get to, if you were in the East Village, you would often run into Joey, you would often run into Tommy or Dee Dee, not as much Johnny. And but honestly, Joey lived within he lived his whole life within a few blocks of his apartment. Okay, when he moved into the East Village, he would go to like Veselka every single day. He would go to Continental every single day. You know what I mean? Every certain things he would walk to. He didn't drive. So he would go to these certain places every day. And then when he got sick, he'd go to Veselka every day and eat oatmeal or vegetable soup. And I would go to Joey's apartment. We would walk to Veselka, which is a Ukrainian diner. It's still there. And we would eat. And then we would go across the street and he wanted to go to Starbucks because Maria Bartiromo like drank Starbucks and he was in love with her. So he was infatuated with her. So he wanted to drink Starbucks. This is when coffee was still cheap here. And it's like, you don't have to buy me a coffee. Like just and he would like want to go in there anyway, just to think about Maria Bartiromo. And then he wrote the song about it. do you know about her at all?
No, not really.
Okay, so there's a song about her on his solo album, his first one, which is, Joey got into the stock market, right? And so she was, on TV, like talking about the stocks and things like this. And so he was, infatuated with her. She was a TV spokesperson, a talking head. But that's who he would see on TV every day. So he felt like he knew her, So he would say, oh, she drinks Starbucks. We got to go in there. Like, I don't want to go in Starbucks. It was like not cool to go in there. You could just go in a deli and get coffee for 50 cents. You know what I mean? But he wanted to go there because she went there. It was kind of funny to know him in different ways, So he would go to the same places in the neighborhood every day, And this video, there was like a video store in his block. And I remember he gave me the VHS tape of Rock and Roll High School. Like he signed it to me, gave it to me. He just rented it. Like he didn't buy it. Just gave it to me. Like lots of funny stories like that. He was a sweet, funny guy. He had a warm heart. And he was, if you were his friend, like he was a good friend, He would call me up and say funny things. And Didi would call me up and say silly things. And they were fun to know. And they had a lot of, they lived a lot in their time. It's sad to think that the last CBGB show, I was sitting there with Hilly Crystal. I'm like, it's so terrible that the Ramones can't play the last show and the Dead Boys can't play the last show. And, just sad, really, that they were gone. And Johnny moved to LA and Dee Dee got buried in Hollywood forever. And then, Johnny has a statue there, and Howie Pyro got buried in Hollywood forever, and so Johnny's Linda, Johnny's widow, she helped to bury our friend Howie Pyro in Hollywood forever, the same place that Dee Dee and Johnny are memorialized in. So we had a beautiful funeral for Howie there, and. So that's one thing that brought Johnny back into the picture was that you that was Joey's girlfriend, Linda, right? And then it became Johnny's wife. She helped to bury Howie Pyro in Hollywood Forever. So that was a beautiful, beautiful thing she did. Because he used to DJ there at all the events. There's events at Hollywood Forever, even though it's a graveyard, they'll play Rock and Roll High School or bands will play there or whatnot. So it's worth checking out. There's a lot of famous celebrities buried there, Burt Reynolds and Toto from Wizard of Oz. And we helped pay for Vampira to be buried there. And now Howie's there and Dee Dee and Johnny has a memorial there too, that big statue.
Well, so tell me, what are you up to nowadays? Are you still playing? I know you've helped with a couple of books and things. What all you got going on?
I worked with Stephen Blush, the author, for many years. He wrote American Hardcore, and I helped write helped him write a new version of American Hardcore, and I helped him write New York Rock. I did some interview, like a contributing editor. I lined up some of the interviews. I wrote some of the questions. I did some of the interviews. We helped We did a book called Lost Rockers that talks about careers of people who didn't make it. Also, did a book about world team tennis. So I've written quite a few things and worked on things with Stephen Blush and working on a couple other things right now too. But I've also been producing music and working with some musicians. And recently I recorded with Buddy Bowser, who was the sax player in New York Dolls,
Oh, yeah.
for a tribute album. So keep you posted when that
Okay.
comes out.
Yeah.
Played with him in Central Park. Once, I keep a hand in it. And when I produce people, I tend to play on the recordings. I produced Soul Cake, which is a New York band here, and I played on some of that and played some shows with them. I played with I've been producing a couple of new artists right now and wait and see how that shapes up. It's going pretty good. And but there's not really not the same industry like it used to be anymore, but
Yeah.
I love music and try to help people get their music finished and recorded and presentable, and they can do something with it and get out and play and things. So, it's rewarding and pays something, and it's kind of word of mouth. Like, I'm not, I don't have a page or something like that where I'm trying to advertise recording or writing my books or even fashion. I'm on social media, but and I'll put up some stuff I worked on and write about it. But I've mostly written about other people, but I've been compiling more and more stories of my own history because the time's gone by, time's changed, these people have passed, and I have memories of things that are just gonna fade if I don't get them down. So, like
That's
things I've
right.
been telling you, people wouldn't even know about some of this stuff if I didn't tell them. So,
Yeah, that's right.
kind of thinking about that. And I have children who are adults now, and they can learn more about me through that too.
Sure.
And so it's kind of people have been urging me more to write my own story. So
Yeah.
I'm not a celebrity per se, that's for sure. But people in New York know me, and especially from a certain era, I know all kinds of people all over.
Well,
But
sure.
a bit lucky.
You don't have to be a celebrity to have an interesting life.
That's very true. And I've been lucky, the people I've met, and that again, kind of just picked up from my folks, just like the nerve to just go up to people and just break the ice and meet and whatever, and put myself out there and not be worried about
Sure.
it. I don't overthink things. I kind of just go for it. And I think that gets you a lot in life sometimes over people who might be over more qualified. Who knows?
Sure.
But like you're doing this podcast, I heard about it from Monty and I listened to him. Like, hey, cool, man. Good for you. So,
Yeah.
keep it going. I like what you're doing.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
It's good to preserve the history of
It
Ramones, and
is. Yeah, that's what I like to do.
I learned some stuff from some of your podcasts. I
Yeah.
heard stories, even though I know those people. I heard a couple of stories I didn't know, and
Sure.
pretty
Well,
cool to hear that. Is there other who else do you have coming up for guests? Other people, I wonder. There's other people. Tish and Snooki were in some videos. You could talk to them too. They're great.
yeah, I mean, I've got
Amen.
several people I've reached out to. I've only had a couple people kind of tell me no or not right now. But I've got some different people. I've got some different photographers, some artists that have done some album covers, and things coming up. I'm gonna do a little something in mid-July, just a little kind of a little, because Adios Amigos will be 30 years old.
Oh,
So
well, okay, speaking of Adios Amigos, that is who I worked for, Mark Crestabi, that artist.
yeah,
So what happened was
that's
when
who
I played with
I'm actually going to be interviewing him. Because he did the cover,
Mark.
right? Yeah, Mark, I got,
Yeah,
yeah.
I worked for him for like 10 years. What happened is I played with Didi, and then Didi said, "Hey, Paul Crestabi, who is Mark's brother, who's the guy in who made White Zombie and made he's also an artist and a musician. He made Psychotic. I played on Lollapalooza, so that's his brother, Paul Ine. So what happened is after I played with Didi, he said, "Hey, why don't you my brother has a TV show and he wants to have a house band." So we start putting a band together, and they had like a cable access show where Mark would pull out his paintings. And people would title the paintings right on the show. And he'd have a bunch of like Warhol people and celebrities there to suggest names, and he had a jury of people that would vote on the names. And if the person won the painting, that would be the name of the painting that they suggested, and they would win money. It was pretty fun. And I be also became the archivist for Mark, where I would photograph every painting with Polaroid, with 35 millimeter, with digital camera, because he would make catalogs and sell his art, a lot of his art, in Italy. But yeah, he's well known for doing the cover of Use Your Illusion
Yeah,
that
right.
became Guns N' Roses album cover. And they even used his title as the title of their album. And then he'll tell you all the story about Adios Amigo. So that's exactly who I was talking about.
But yeah,
So this is all coming together
that's
that
right.
way, that
That's right.
the small it's a small world,
It sure
because
is.
Mark's brother Paul was doing a lot of art with Didi, so he knew Didi. Him and his brother grew up in LA in Whittier, and I mean, actually, that's in Whittier, California, they grew up, and they were artists out there and musicians out there. And so they knew all the musicians out there. But when they moved here in the 80s, Paul had White Zombie, formed White Zombie here. And then he had a band called Youth Gone Mad out there. And then at the end, towards the end of Dee Dee life, Dee Dee joined Youth Gone Mad. So the last Dee Dee album is Youth Gone Mad featuring Dee Dee Ramone. That's the album I played on. So yeah, so that's great. You'll have Mark on, and his brother Paul is another guy that was very close to all the Ramones and all punk rock and all musicians and artists. So it's that circle of people. So
It
that's
is.
cool.
And well, let's wrap this up. You said you don't really have a page, but do you have, and you said you did have social media. Do you have
Yeah,
a
I'm on Instagram. I'm on Instagram as Tony Mann, and
Okay.
I'm also on Instagram, where I kind of show more of my clothes as Werewolf NYC,
Okay.
and it's Werewolf, I think, underscore NYC
Okay.
is the Instagram, and I'm on Facebook as Tony Mann, MANN,
All right.
and
Well,
yeah, reach out if you heard this or something. And
yeah.
Dave, thanks for having me on. It's been nice talking to you and
It,
telling me this
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah, you too. And I feel like we're gonna have to probably revisit and do a part two down the road and just and tell
Okay,
more stuff, because I feel like
if you have any other questions, cool. And I'd be happy to answer and
Sure.
send you some more info or photos or whatever. But yeah, you
Sounds
can reach
great.
out. I'm here.
All
And
right.
thanks for your time. And
Yeah.
Gabba gabba, hey everybody out there. Thanks for listening to the Pinhead Podcast.
Hey, Bruiser buddies, I want you to listen to Wrestling Nostalgia with Dave Dynasty. Every week, he has the roughest and toughest interviews in the podcast world today, with the best guests you could ask for. There's no bums on this show. Let Dave Dynasty be your podcasting tag team partner and listen to Wrestling Nostalgia while drinking beer, smoking cigars, and busting heads. Just look it up on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe today, because the Bruiser said so.
All right, and thank you to Tony for joining me on this episode of Pinhead Pod. Now, next episode, like I said earlier, there will be a bonus episode. It will release on July 18th, and it will be in celebration of the 30th anniversary of the release of the Ramones' final studio album, Adios Amigos. Joining me on that episode will be Monty A. Melnick, Ramones' tour manager, and Mark Kostabi, who painted the cover art. So that is coming up July 18th, a bonus episode celebrating the 30th anniversary of Adios Amigos. Thank you to all of you for listening and following us. Be sure to tell all your friends and fellow Ramones fans about the podcast and continue to help us grow. Be sure to subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform. Plus, leave us a rating and review. That helps us with all those algorithms find new fans, new listeners, new followers. Also, be sure to follow us on social media. We're on pretty much all of the platforms. Just search for Pinhead Pod. And be sure to share our posts and help the podcast audience grow. You can also give us feedback, suggestions, tell us your Ramones stories, etc. on those platforms. All right, until July 18th with that bonus episode when we all celebrate the 30th anniversary of Adios Amigos. Be good, be safe, and gabba gabba hey!